what I said.
James is darn good. But he's better. And I'm better than both of them. No brag, just fact.
Girl, you taught me how to hurt real bad and cry myself to sleep. Show me how this town shattered dreams. Another lesson about a naive fool who came to Babylon. Found out that the pie don't taste so sweet. Now his guitar, Cadillac, Bill, Bill, and music. Lonely, lonely streets that I call home. Yeah, my guitar's Cadillac, Bill, Bill, and music. The only thing that keeps me hanging on. Thank you, girl, for teaching me brand new ways to be cruel. If I can find my mind now, I guess I'll just leave. And his guitar's Cadillac, Bill, Bill, and music. Lonely, lonely streets that I call home. Yeah, my guitar's Cadillac, Bill, Bill, and music.
The number of people looking to buy firearms is up nearly 50% compared to 2007, according to the FBI.
In the month of November, our gun sales were probably comfortably 250% of what an average month is.
All in favor of losing your rights? Please do nothing.
This rally is not about guns. But what these guns that everybody's going to wear represent is the true badge of the free man. That he can bear arms in defense of himself without permission from anyone. And that's what these arms represent.
Gun laws in the U.S. vary by state, and the amount of regulation is a hot-button political issue.
You have associated two U.S. senators and associating them or comparing them to terrorists. I said, well, they are. Okay.
Can't take me.
Fill your hand, you son of a bitch.
You can't take me.
And it's time for the Shooting Bench. If political incorrectness offends you, or if you don't like guns, or if you don't believe our government is corrupt enough to compare to 1938 Nazi Germany, this may not be the show for you, because for the next 2 hours, that's all we're going to talk about. You need to understand that there's a storm coming. You need to understand that the storm is building strength. And most of all, you need to understand that
we are the storm.
All right, here we are. Welcome to the Shooting Bench. It is Monday. Hope everyone had a good weekend. Let me move a little deal up here real quick. There we go. It'll be ready when I need it. Got some different stuff for you tonight. I'm not going to get into the doom and gloom and politics here for a little while, maybe later on in the show, depending on how much time we have. But I got some other stuff I think would be kind of interesting to you. I think we just worked this weekend. I didn't do anything very, very exciting. But weather's been great. We've had a lot of snow, and now it's all of a sudden, not a lot compared to, I guess, in Washington in some places. They've been getting hammered. But we got quite a bit. We got 30 inches here in some places. And now it's the cotton picking muddy and around. It's unbelievable. Warm it up, really nice days, so we'll be out doing other stuff pretty quick. I got a hydraulic leak to fix on my backhoe and a few other little odds and ends of things that need done outside, so weather's going to allow for that now. Hope you all did well this weekend. I've talked to you guys before a time or two. I've never gone into much detail. I told you that we had relatives, ancestors from way back over in Catherine County, New Mexico. That's where all the family come from on my dad's side of the family. From way, way back. I believe it was 1885, I think it was, when our first family member settled. We were related to the first six families, I think, that settled over there. There was the Burks and the Laneys and the Swaps and the Hamblins and Reynolds and I think there was one more, and I can't remember who it is right offhand. But this goes way, way back. So, and most of you know that a lot of my ancestors, especially on my dad's side, some on my mom's side, but one on my dad's side, are the vast majority of them were Mormon pioneers. They come out here from Missouri back in the mid-1800s. And eventually, you know, a few of them drifted down here or were sent down here to settle this part of the country. This is a very strong, large LDS population down in this part of Arizona, actually all of Arizona, and that part of New Mexico there. And what I'm getting to is the pioneer heritage that I have and that our family does. And pretty interesting. It goes back to, mine on my dad's side, I don't know how many of them there is. We're still researching this. I know some of my family has done quite a bit of this already, and I'm lagging way behind. Of course, they've done a lot of that work for me, and I've just been able to read some of it. But I went today, Amy and I went into a site and studied some old stuff. Now, there was a guy named Jacob Hamblin, who was my, I think, great-great-granddad, maybe three greats, I don't remember. But I'll have to check on that. Great-great, I believe. And he had a brother named Frederick. And Frederick was down here in this part of the country prior to Jacob coming down here. And
Frederick, as a matter of fact, negotiated the deal for the land where Alpine, Arizona sits today. And if you go over, I think I mentioned this some time ago, probably about 5 years ago, but the old Luna store over there, the old log cabin, still standing, still, you know, still, I think there's somebody living in it now, or it's up for sale, I don't know. But it's still in good shape. And if you look on the west side of that store, down about probably 2 feet above ground level, now I don't know what the... what it looked like inside that building back in those days, back in the 1800s, and where the floor was located exactly. But in the walls there are, and I've got pictures of them, in the walls there is shooting ports. And when there was, there's three of them, I believe, on that west side of the wall. And they're down pretty low. Obviously, right now, where the floor is, the floor, the people would be under the floor shooting. So I'm sure that that wasn't the case. So I imagine they'd had a dirt floor back in those days, and just guessing. But anyway, there's these shooting ports were there where they'd get attacked by Indians every once in a while. And this thing's made out of logs that are probably, you know, 14 inches thick or better. Yeah, some of them's heavier than that. And they'd use those shooting ports to hold off the Indians when they'd get attacked by Apaches. Then they would hold them off the best they could until the cavalry got there from Springerville, an Eager area. And sometimes they had to hold out for a little while, and sometimes they had it all taken care of by the time the cavalry got there. But anyway. So, Jacob Hamblin was a missionary, and he spent a lot of time with the Indians, primarily the Navajos. And he, I'm reading doc stuff about 1911s here on the, yeah, that's, we're a little bit pre-1911 anyway. Jacob Hamblin was a missionary, and when he died, he was, yes, Deschutes in Catron County. He was buried in St. George, Utah, and some years later, they dug him up and moved him. He's now over here in Springerville, Alpine. So, there was a story that I heard quite often when I was a kid. And it varied a little bit because we didn't have the, I guess it was passed down to the, passed down to the family from, you know, different members of the family. But anyway, the story went that, Frederick was, hang on a minute. Let me check on this deal here right quick before I get, okay. I got somebody in on another program here saying that the sound is dragging and slow. So let me know what the sound's doing there. I may need to, I think I have everything set correctly, but let me know what the sound sounds like there. And I did figure out some new stuff. I told you I'd get it all figured out, and I did. There will be, we are going to revolutionize Liberty Lounge here coming this Friday. So, yeah, that's right, Doc. Doc says, for those of you that are not in the chat room, Doc says that St. George was a lot of where a lot of the downwinders. These were people, they still call them downwinders today. A lot of people that were subjected to fallout from nuclear tests up in out in the not White Sands, but out in the what do they call it place out there where they Miniman Pin, I'll tell them that. I think that's exactly what that person is on here. So let's see here. Let me see if I can get everybody that's not on the chat room squared away. All right, there we go. And Susie B., I don't know what to tell you. Darling, if you haven't got sound there, you'll have to go to tune in. All right, let's go. I'm going to start, the Nevada test site. I'm not sure what it is. I thought they had I wanted to say White Sands, but obviously that's in New Mexico. But anyway, there's a test site out there north of north and I believe a little west of Vegas. And I think that's not too far from where the Mercury, what do they call the place? The Mercury something or another? Or maybe the town that was just Mercury. I don't know. You know, I've been through there half dozen times or a dozen times. And anyway, let me get on to this story here. Let's see. Now I got two conflicting stories here. I usually don't do this, but I've got some other listeners in here tonight just especially for this show. Okay. All right, we got that taken care of then. All right, let's get on with it here. So let me just do this. This story is kind of long. I think you'll enjoy it. Now remember, this is a firsthand account from Frederick's daughter. She was there at the time, the very night that Frederick came in after his ordeal there, and there are other family members who have corroborated this story, and far as I know, it is 100% true. So this was bad. What it doesn't give is the exact year. So it had to have been somewhere, it was one of the last, if not the last, grizzly bears in that part of the country. But I don't know exactly what the year was. So this is an account written by Emily Jepson, who is his daughter. This is a story of hers, let's see, I got to separate. All right, now this part I'm reading right now, this excerpt, is not from Emily. This is from someone else. This is a story of great-grandfather's fight with the bear. Should be especially interesting to anyone of whose ancestors come from Alpine, Arizona. Uncle Fred was Jacob Hamblin's younger brother. And, of course, an uncle to my grandmother, Ella. All of us kids called him Uncle Fred, and most everyone else did, too. Over the years, there have been many versions of this story and the details of what happened in the area where it happened. The account written by his daughter, Emily Jepson, I believe, accurately gives the details of the struggle, how it happened, and when. She did not define the area location where it took place. Lloyd Hamblin, Uncle Fred's nephew, and the son of Frank Hamblin, who was the son who helped his father into the house that night, said this fight took place beginning on Uncle Fred's land about 4 miles south and east of Alpine. This land, which became his son Frank's land, lies south of the highway, about a quarter mile from where you get to the road going to the Blue. Now, for some of you remember, a lot of you on the chat room remember Amy's interview with that wilderness doctor. From out in the Blue. He lived out in the Blue area. And I don't know if he's still alive or not. He was getting awfully old, but he was in good shape. He's probably still kicking, doing fine. So anyway, this fight culminated in the mountains west of the old Tenney homestead. We should be aware that Jacob Hamblin, the great missionary to the Navajos, was not the only surname in early church history. His brother Frederick Hamblin also settled here. So, anyway, here's the story from the daughter. And like I said, there's other family members that were there that night also. My father, Frederick Hamblin, was the first Mormon settler in Alpine, Arizona. He was always a pioneer, first as a boy in Utah and then in Arizona. He loved the freedom of the mountains and the small towns. He loved to fish and hunt, and that was his sport and recreation. In those days, there was no restriction of game and fish. One could go at his will. As there was an abundance of both, Father went out often and seldom returned empty-handed. one fall, here's the date right here, 1890 or 1891, the snow came early. First week in November, a heavy snow covered the ground to a depth of a foot and a half and deeper in the mountains, making it ideal for hunting, as tracking and trailing could be done so easily. The morning was clear, so about noon, Father saddled his best horse, took his gun with a belt of bullets, and laughingly told the folks at home to have the grease hot and ready for a mess of fresh venison. Some 5 or 6 miles from home, Father came upon a deer track, which he began following. After following it for half a mile or so, he saw the track of a big bear, which had come from another direction and was also following the deer. He decided to follow on and perhaps get both, especially if the bear overtook the deer. He followed a long way, perhaps 3 or 4 miles, and he saw the bear had given up and turned into a thicket. The sun was now getting low, and he was getting very tired from the continual climb uphill in the deep snow, and he decided to rest a little and then start back to his horse, which he had left at the foot of the mountain some 4 or 5 miles away. Father sat down on a fallen tree to rest, but soon became uneasy and had the feeling of being watched. He looked carefully in every direction, but could see nothing to justify the feeling. So he sat still, perhaps a minute longer. He still had the creepy feeling, so he arose and started down the mountain. When he heard a noise, and turning, he saw a huge grizzly bear coming out of the thicket towards him. He quickly leveled his gun and shot the bear, wounding it badly. The bear ran up the mountainside, and Father followed, thinking it would die soon, but it went on and on. He came to a place where the bear and the snow came to a place where the bear and the snow all around was soaked with blood. I think that's a typo right there. But the bear was nowhere in sight. Father was very tired now and thought that he could barely have time to reach his horse before dark, so he decided to give up the chase for that day. He would come back on the morrow and get the bear. In those days, the gun only held one bullet at a time, and as the brush was so thick, Father took the bullet from the gun to make sure of no accident while he was going down the mountain. Now there's a good safety thing for you. Of course, I don't know if I'd do it in grizzly bear country, but I guess there's enough accidents of hanging triggers up on brush and hammers and stuff that he elected to make the gun safe. He had just emptied the gun and hadn't started back yet when he heard a terrible snarl, and the beast was upon him, striking him on the shoulder, its sharp claws tearing his clothes and also his flesh. Father used the gun as a club, striking the bear in the face with all his might, with little or no effect, with the bear striking the gun to ward off the blows. Father then took the gun in both hands, a hand at each end of the barrel, and when the bear would attack, strike it with all his strength in the mouth. This way, he broke several of his front teeth out. He tried to turn the gun to get the end of the gun into the bear's mouth, thinking he might force it so far down his throat as to make it give up, but this he could not do. Now, right there is where the story is different, because I was always told when I was a kid that Uncle Frederick had taken and shoved that bear in, I mean, that rifle in the bear's mouth, and he couldn't get it back out. He shoved it in there hard enough, and of course, the bear run off with the rifle, and he choked to death on it. That's not exactly the case, but it was close. The angry bear kept trying to get its huge arms around him, which Father strove constantly to avert, as he knew one squeeze of those powerful arms would crush every bone in his chest. It is impossible to know how long this fierce struggle lasted, but long enough that both man and beast were almost exhausted. I suppose everyone knows that bears cuff each other in their play and use the same motions or means in their fighting, only, of course, putting all the force they can muster into the blows when fighting. This grizzly, finding he was unable to get his arms around Father, drew back his huge paws and struck at Father's head with all his force, which Father dodged, but it hit the gun, knocking it several feet away, thus leaving him entirely without protection. Both man and beast were working to keep to the upper hillside, as that gave the advantage. The bear struck his right hand 2 or 3 times with his sharp claws, tearing his hand to shreds. It was now helpless. One of Father's heels caught, and his strength seemed almost gone. He could feel the bear's hot breath on his face and decided that he was lost. with his back downhill and that fierce beast upon him, he was ready to give up. Just then it seemed an unseen power raised him up and gave him strength. As he righted himself, he caught the eyes of the bear in a close stare. Father was a large man, standing 6'3" in his stocking feet. The bear was so tall his paws rested straight on Father's shoulders, and they were now in this position. The face of the bear was so near Father's face he could feel every breath. At the first stare, the bear stood still, and as Father continued to stare, he dropped down on all fours and started slowly away. Father stood and stared at the bear, which went a little way, stopped and looked back, and then walked on. Father dropped down exhausted, but kept watching the bear until it was out of sight. Then, taking the red bandana handkerchief from his pocket, he wrapped his hand, which was bleeding profusely, and picked up the remains of his gun. He found the gun with the stock broken, the sights knocked off, and the hammer bent. The marks of the bear's teeth all over the barrel, he knew the gun would never shoot again, but it had been the means of saving his life. He also picked up a claw that had been torn from the bear's foot. This measured 3 inches long. With these in hand, he started his weary way down the mountainside. Twice before he reached his horse, he was overcome with exhaustion from the loss of blood and his trying experience, and lay down thinking he would die there, but after a little rest, he would go on again. Darkness fell, as the trees were so thick, they shut out the light sky. They shut out the light sky that is directly above, so it is a wonder he ever found his horse. His clothing being wet and cold from the snow and the cold night air made so stiff and uncomfortable that he decided to make a fire and warm up before starting home. However, his hand was so badly torn as to be rendered helpless, and all the wood being wet made this impossible. Wearily, he dragged himself into the saddle and gave the horse his reins. It being gentle, took the trail homeward without urging or guiding, which was a great advantage for Father as he was practically unable to do anything more than balance himself in the saddle. While Father was going through this terrible and never-to-be-forgotten experience, his family was at their ranch homestead, happily doing their daily tasks, unmindful of the fierce struggle taking place in the lonely snow-covered mountain 10 miles away. The sun slipped behind the western mountains, the evening chores were done, and soon after dark a nice hot supper was waiting until Father returned to his place at the head of the table. Still, we weren't really worried, as we expected him to come home each minute. A pale, cloud-streaked moon arose with very little light and an icy wind began blowing. By now, we children could see that Mother was worried, but what could be done? We did not know just where Father intended to hunt, and if we had known, how far in another direction might he have gone. The two smaller children were put to bed, but Mother and my brother Frank and myself could neither eat nor sleep. 2 or 3 dreary hours passed by, and still Father hasn't come, and the night was bitter cold. At last, Frank, who was just a boy, yet knew the country well, said he would get a horse and go into town and get someone to help him look for Father. He had been gone from the house for about 10 minutes when he met Father coming. When he got near him, he called, "Is that you, Pa?" There were no words spoken for some time, as he was too weak and overcome with exhaustion. Great was our joy when we heard the approaching horseman. Mother hurried about replenishing the fires and seeing that supper was warm again, never expecting things not to go right with Father. He did not come as we expected, and from the sound we knew that something was wrong. Mother opened the door and saw Frank half carrying Father, whose face was deathly white, and his clothes torn, blood-stained, and frozen to him. It was a sight one could never forget. We got him to the house, seated him in a big chair around an open fire. The big handkerchief wrapped around his wounded hand was frozen stiff, but that had probably stopped the bleeding and saved his life, and perhaps saved his life. He was suffering from shock, exhaustion, hunger, and cold, and could not speak. It was perhaps an hour before he could stand up to have any of his wet and bloody clothes removed. During that time, Frank went to the kitchen to get a drink of water. I followed him and asked what had happened to Father. "I don't know," he said. "He couldn't tell me." Mother got him to drink a few swallows of hot soup, which revived him some. Then Mother said, "What hurt you?" He could only say, "A bear." Mother dressed his hands with clean bandages and finally got him into bed. Although he didn't sleep that night, days passed. Still, Father did not say a word of what happened, and his eyes were kind of dazed, far-away look, which was, of course, shock. It was 5 or 6 days before he told us the thing that happened. Then one evening he told us the story, which I have tried to tell as he did, but that was a long time ago, and I may have omitted some things. It may be at this period of history that this part is funny. And of course, we know this isn't true. We know that there may have been other factors involved in why infection and stuff didn't set in. But this girl said it may be at this period of history germs hadn't reached this far west, for his hand healed nicely, as did the large gash in his shoulder. So, you know, I would guess that, whether it was the, a combination of the cold, proper care when he got there, and maybe some divine intervention, you don't know. But it wasn't because germs hadn't reached that far west yet. Anyway, all of this without the aid of a doctor, for at that time there was no doctor in the country. Father polished the large claw that he had picked up and used it for years as a watch fob, afterwards giving it to his boyhood friend. The following spring, a cowboy found the remains of the largest bear he had ever seen, and as several front teeth were broken off and a claw missing from one of its front toes, he knew it was the one Father had fought with. Father was modest and didn't tell his story often, and then only to the ones he chose, not to everyone. Perhaps he wouldn't approve of my telling it now. We tell this story not to aggrandize one man's memory, but to preserve a part of history and to help us appreciate the trials and blessings that our forefathers received in the early days. Incidentally, Sister Van Cleve informed us that several years ago the Mesa Public Library, when in its previous building, had a pioneer exhibit which included Frederick Hamblin's gun as one of the items on display. The exhibit was burglarized, and the only thing taken was this gun. So that's the story of, let's see, what's D. Schutz putting up here? Let me check that out and see what's going on here. It had something to do with Hamblin here. Oh, that's Isaiah Hamblin. That was one of Frederick's, I think it was Frederick's dad, maybe? I don't remember. We saw Isaiah Hamblin today. While we're looking for all this stuff. But there are, looks like that's a pretty interesting story there too. There's just tons of this kind of stuff in our history, in the Reynolds and Hamblin family history there. So, there's, go back up through here and check and see. I'm glad you said that. Thank you. I think we got him squared away on TuneIn there, the one that was getting hold of him. Okay, well, I am going to take a break, and when I come back, we'll go into some other stuff here.
Now, Elmer Jones arose at dawn and put his hunting breeches on, then looked up at his shotgun on the wall. He made his mind up then and there to bag himself at shooting. He had plenty on the ball. He milked the cow and fed the hog, then kissed his wife, called the dog, picked up his gun and started on his quest. He crossed the creek and hit the trees, threw back his head and sniffed the breeze, let out a yell and pounded on his chest.
Here comes Elmer, Elmer's got his gun. Here comes Elmer, run, bear, run.
He hunted all the morning through, but not a bear came into view while Elmer's thoughts were on the kitchen range. He was sick as he could be of lamb and chicken fricassee and craved a mess of bear meat for a change. Poor Elmer's mind was in a fog. He paused and sat down on a log to get his back lid back in the groove. He heard a noise, and standing there before him was a grizzly bear, and figured it was time he made his move.
Here comes Elmer. Elmer's got his gun. Here comes Elmer. Run, bear, run.
His gun and turned around, but Mr. Bear just stood his ground, and Elmer said, it's either me or thou. The gun refused to go, and so he knew that somebody had to go, and said, farewell, I'm leaving as of now. Elmer's shoulders sprouted wings, his feet developed inner springs. To linger longer, he was disinclined. He ran so fast through muck and mire, his ankles set his socks afire. And still that bear kept coming on behind.
Here comes Elmer. Elmer's got his gun. Here comes Elmer. Run, bear, run.
A deer with antler 8 feet wide got in the way of Elmer's stride as both of them went heading for the brush. Elmer said, now listen, son, if that's the fastest you can run, move over, because I'm really in a rush. The bear was gaining inch by inch and finally reached out for the clinch as Elmer saw the fence around his place. He leaped the fence and landed hard, jumped 60 feet across the yard and slammed the kitchen door in Bruin's face.
Here comes Elmer. Elmer's got his gun.
Was trying to get inside while Elmer sought a place to hide, and Mrs. Jones began to pull her hair. She said, this fuss has got to stop. Why don't you let that matter drop? And Elmer said, honey, you go tell that to the bear. Then Elmer's wife said, listen, goon, how come you think good Daniel Boone, whose appetite on bear meat used to thrive? He said, I'm sure that you're aware that Daniel always killed his bear, but honey, I done brought this baby home alive.
Here comes Elmer. Elmer's got his gun.
But we have to stop looking for salvation in this system. The system is not going to fix itself. If the system is restored, it will be restored with the hammer of patriotism smacking this system out between the anvil of freedom and teaching this system that there is a shape we wanted to maintain, and that we have the forge of rage, and we will put that system in that forge of rage, and we will use that hammer of liberty and pound it against the anvil of freedom until it returns to the shape we want it to be in.
Are you going to agree? Our freedoms are waning and we'll lose our liberty, slipping one by one until there's nothing left to see. Are you willing to stand with me? Are you just going to let it be? The ranchers are first, but brother, next it may be me. We all stand together or we'll hang separately. Are you going to the tree? Are you willing to be free? It won't get any easier to regain lost liberty. Strange things are happening in this land that once was free. So brother, I ask you, are you going to stand by me?
Guns, self-defense, survival, current events, and your future.
Can't take me.
We're rapidly approaching desperate times. Have you prepared your family physically, mentally, spiritually to face these times? The tyrant has overstepped his authority. What will you do when he comes to your door?
You can't take me.
The Shooting Bench, 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, 10 to midnight Central.
It's easy to take liberty for granted when you've never had it taken from you.
That's what I like to see, bullseyes every time. And you can do the same thing with Byers Barrels. As long as you do your part, the custom barrels that you get from Byers Barrels will deliver award-winning accuracy shot after shot. Byers Barrel specializes in standard and 1-in-9-inch twist match-grade 22 long rifle barrels for the Ruger 10/22 and AR-15. If you want to win, visit their site at ByersBarrels.com. That's DeyerBarrels.com. Or you can call Clint at 360-374-9476 and tell him you heard it on the Shooting Fence, would you? Let him know that his advertising money is doing him some good. Welcome back to another segment of the Shooting Bench, right here on the Survival Circle Radio Network. Okay, we're back. You know, there's another listener from over in New Mexico that's listening and getting a hold of me here by text, and he reminded me of another guy out there, and you guys can check on this. There's a guy named Ben Lilly that used to live over in the Luna area, and he is a there's at least one book about Ben Lilly out there, and he was quite the hunter. Matter of fact, that's all he did, was hunt, and lots of neat stories about Ben Lilly, and he took out people like Teddy Roosevelt, I think, is what we've got. That guy had sent me a picture of an aspen tree up there that has an old carving in it that was from, I think it was Teddy Roosevelt. It was one of the Roosevelts. Anyway, you can look that up. There's a lot of neat stories, a lot of documentation. But the story is that there's a chicken hawk or a falcon or something got in there and killed one of his wife's chickens one time. And she said, "Ben, you go get that hawk and don't you come back till you got him." And story has it that he came back 2 years later with the hawk. I don't know if that's true or not. But anyway, he was very persistent. He was a legendary tracker. And the stories about him are endless. Some of them are true. Some of them probably embellished considerably. But anyway, he was a true-to-life Jeremiah Johnson out there. Neat guy. He was like the guy I told you guys, what was it, a month or so ago, a couple of months ago? I was telling you about Gus Rainey, who was also from New Mexico up in the what used to be Valencia County. It's now Cibola County. Cibola is what is how it's supposed to be pronounced. They call it Cibola. But he was another character. I won't go into that because we spent half a show talking about him here back when we did that. So anyway, let me get my crystal ball fired up here because there's lots of other things. I'm not going to nearly have time to do them, as many of them as I, excuse me, as I wanted to do tonight. But I run across that story about Frederick Hamblin and just had to share that with you. I haven't read this story yet, so we're going to read it together. It says the second highest ranking official at the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms recently authored a proposal to modify and reduce gun regulations in the United States. The 11-page white paper obtained by the Washington Post and drafted by the ATF's Associate Deputy Director and Chief Operating Officer Ronald B. Turk includes, but is not limited to, the following proposals: removing restrictions on the sale of suppressors, conducting a study concerned with lifting the ban on imported assault weapons, and requiring a higher amount of crime guns to be traced back to specific dealers before the federal government asks for additional information from those dealers. Turk writes in the introduction to the paper entitled Options to Reduce or Modify Firearms Regulations that these general thoughts provide potential ways to reduce or modify regulations or suggest changes that promote commerce and defend the Second Amendment without significant negative impact on the ATF's mission to fight violent firearms crime and regulate the firearms industry. This white paper is intended to provide ideas and provoke conversation. It is not guidance or policy of any kind. So, I think this is probably, you know, smoke and mirrors here. I think he's throwing that out there to, you know, to kind of get us to drop our guard, not pay attention to what all is going on. But we'll see what happens. It sounds, you know, very optimistic. There's more to the stories than this, but there's a couple things here on down here a little bit. The Washington Post said that ATF spokeswoman Jan Kemp said Turk's proposals do not represent the views of the agency. Imagine my surprise. It's simply his opinion, and it's to generate dialogue. Perhaps Turk's most timely proposal has to do with the removing restrictions on suppressors, also known as silencers. The Hearing Protection Act, a current bill making waves in the U.S. Congress, would make it much easier to purchase silencers, eliminating the tax and the long waiting period. Silencers are very rarely used in criminal shootings, Turk writes. Given the lack of criminality associated with silencers, it's reasonable to conclude that they should not be viewed as a threat to public safety. At least there's one guy with a small bit of common sense in the ATF. In addition to deregulating silencers, he suggests removing restrictions on imported assault weapons, pointing out that many semi-automatic assault rifles are now used in sport shooting. Those firearm types are now standard for hunting activities. These restrictions have placed many limitations on importers while at the same time imposing a heavy workload on the ATF. So, story is quite a bit longer than this, but I'm not going to go through all of it, but I thought that was kind of a refreshing deal there. I don't doubt that we'll see absolutely anything whatsoever come out of it, but it's nice to dream anyway. Now, here's something that, let me go check my chat room here. I haven't been looking to see what's going on. I might be missing all kinds of stuff. Hey, Dee just put in a couple things about Ben Lilly there. And I really would like to see you guys go and check on that. It's extremely, extremely interesting stuff. And this is the type of people that my family was. My family was quite acquainted with Ben Lilly back in the day. And that was kind of the norm around there, around for folks in that part of the country, I guess. But anyway. Okay. Here is, that's right, Doc. That's absolutely right. That's one of the things that hopefully this ATF guy is trying to push through here, is the fact that a lot of these semi-automatic rifles are used in many of the shooting sports. Okay, here's something that has not been done much at all. As I said here the other day, I said things are changing. People are waking up. People are starting to stand a little bit more, quite a bit more than they did literally only a year ago. Certainly more, you know, 2 to 5 years ago and even more, people didn't, people didn't do this. And if more people would do what these people are doing, a lot less government overreach would be taking place. What happened here, and Doc may know this story, this happened in Mississippi. Excuse me. There was a mayor down there. What town is this? It's in Rienzi, evidently, where an atheist group had threatened a lawsuit and forced a mayor to take down a Christian flag. And it says more than 100 supporters united at the Veterans Memorial Park, where the group waved Christian flags, red cross on a blue background, in the upper left corner of an all-white base. The mayor said, "I never dreamed that something like this would have happened in a town this small, but it happened." He said, "We're going to fly that flag again," he said, "and I'm hoping that it's not going to be long before it happens." Williams said, the mayor said he removed the Christian flag after receiving a letter from the Freedom From Religion Foundation that stated a $500,000 lawsuit could be filed against him if the town did not remove the flag. Now, that right there, that it would seem to me that it's one thing to threaten a lawsuit. It's another to get everything together and actually do it. And my guess is, I may be wrong, has happened one other time in my life, but my guess is even if they did file it and they decided to take the flag down after it was filed, that it seems there would be no grounds for it and it would stop it right there. So I don't know what the legalities are on that. But anyway, the fact of the matter is that he took the flag down with a letter that threatened to sue him. That's not standing. But these other 100 people here, that's standing. He said, "I'm telling you folks, I'm no preacher, but it's going to get worse. Can I get an amen? It's going to get worse, but we cannot bow down. We cannot lay down. If we stand up till our death, that's what we need to do." And that was from those words were from the community, from the event organizer there. The guy's name's Kevin. Yeah, he's got it right. We can't just bow down on because they say stuff. We got to stand up till our death. That's what we need to do. He said there comes a point in time when you've got to be politically incorrect and take a stand. During the rally, supporters returned a Christian flag to the flagpole where it once flew. He said, "I'm a proud American, but number one, as a proud Christian, I came today to stand up for the Lord and stand up for our freedom." That was a woman that was in the group there. Williams said the town has hired an attorney and will discuss the next step regarding the flags in a meeting scheduled for September 7th. So tomorrow we should get an update on this story with any luck here. Oh, that kind of stuff ticks me off till I can't stand it. Anyway. And I'm kind of taking these randomly here because we're not going to have nearly the time that I wanted to go through some of these, but we'll hit them again Wednesday, get caught up here. I've got some really good stories. We're just not going to have time to do it. In Florida, school was shut down there for a little while because teachers found a gun in kids' backpacks, in a kid's backpack. Said the gun was found when another student reported an item missing, and while searching for that item, the staff instead found the gun. Gun was confiscated, law enforcement called, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I saw another story today where a 12-year-old had been charged with murder and robbery. So it's that whole going to hell in a handbasket deal. I'm going to read this story prior to talking about it. We've talked about it again. It's an update on a story we did 2 or 3 years ago. So I need to study up on it a little bit. There was a deal on Facebook where some guy or some gal said, "Do you support, how'd they put it, do you support it said, since when did illegal aliens have constitutional rights, or since when did the Constitution apply to these illegal aliens?" And everybody, without one exception, many responses, never, never, the Constitution only applies to I said, whoa, wait a minute. What are you two talking about? I said, the Constitution applies to every human being that sets foot in this country, no matter where they came from, until or unless they become a convicted felon. And even then, there are some basic rights that never go away. I mean, you still have the right to, you know, again, it's cruel and unusual punishment and whatever else, but there's some things that that you have no matter what. And these guys, now, I also found it very odd that these people, all of the people, there was probably a, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 responses after that. And fortunately, it's probably some of my people that follow me on Facebook that saw that and come in and chimed in too and backed me up on this, you know, talking about the United States becoming a fascist nation and one thing and another. But, and then that was the end of it. None of the other people, not one of them, come back and try to defend their position on the Constitution not applying to aliens. Not one. And I found it very, very strange for Facebook, because people will usually fight even when they know they're wrong, because they are safely tucked away in their mom's basement behind a monitor of their laptop. And even when no right, wrong, or indifferent, they'll argue about it. But I found it very, very strange, kind of refreshing, actually. I found it very strange that not one of those people come back and tried to defend their position. Okay, well, wait, hang on a minute. Let me get this out of my... Okay, I'm back. Goodness me. All right, I hope you all enjoyed the story about Uncle Fred and some of the bear stuff we had going on there, and Elmer and the bear and whatnot. And I do, again, strongly encourage you guys to look up the stories on Ben Lilly, or the books on Ben Lilly. Do some internet searches. Dee was gracious enough to put some links up there for you. Check them out. It's neat stuff. All right. Well, I'm going to scoot on out of here. We'll see you Wednesday. I'm about to get this new software figured out here so we can actually have good, productive, semi-intelligent shows here. So good night, and I'll see you Wednesday. And don't forget to join me Friday for Liberty Lounge, and Living Way Out Here will be on right prior to Liberty Lounge. Well, that wraps up another edition of the Shooting Bench. Join me Monday and Wednesday from 8 to 10 p.m. Pacific, and again on Fridays from 7 to 10 for the Shooting Bench. Good night, and thanks for joining me. No reconciliation. No, let's talk it over. Number I can call. Goodbye says it all.